Talk to Angela. Thanks everyone for bearing with us. We're doing this completely remotely from different places. So, perfect. Great. Everyone should be able to see our agenda on our screen. And should be able to speak on the line.
Rosa, this is Genevieve. Yes, you can. Your screen is visible.
Excellent.
Okay, well, this is Genevieve. I think we'll start with the call to order and roll call. And looks like we have about 27 attendees online. That's excellent. Again, this, you're here for the Healthcare Associated Infections Advisory Committee meeting for June 10th, 2020. And we'll have about an hour and 15 minutes to go through our agenda today. So first of all, so I've just introduced myself and I'll be your chair for today. Rosa, how do you want to go through roll call, or should we just instruct people to look at the attendees list that's provided on the right hand side?
I think it would be. I do see the attendees list. If folks are able to unmute themselves and would like to introduce themselves, I think that would be great. And please, just as a friendly reminder, to unmute yourselves. Let's see, I'm manually unmuting as I can. There are some of you who are self-muted, so please unmute yourself with that little
microphone.
Okay, this is Genevieve. What I'll do is I'll go ahead while we're getting Rosa back online. We'll go ahead and go to approve the March 2020 minutes. And if you would like to approve them, please unmute yourself and give your approval. And we need approval and a second, please.
It said it muted by organizer up until the microphone just changed. So Jesse Kennedy, I'm here.
Great, thank you. Were you also able to give an approval for the March 2020 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, great, thanks. Is there anyone that has a second for the minutes?
This is Deborah Katora, I'll second it.
Great, thank you. So the March minutes are so approved. At this point, I'm going to check in. Rosa, are you available to do the logistics update? Sounds like not quite at this moment. Becca, I'm going to see if we would like to move ahead on the agenda to the situational awareness around COVID-19, and then we have Rosa back on. We'll return to the logistics update at that time.
Hi, Genevieve. This is Angela. Rosa just sent me a message saying Becca is not going to be able to join us on this call, unfortunately.
Is someone else going to be delivering the situational overview, or should we just proceed?
Let me check real quick.
Okay.
Do we know if we have a quorum, or if we have who we all have on the line?
That was preempted because of Rosa, not something happening with Rosa's thing. However, you can look at the in the right-hand box there under attendees. We should be able to determine from that if there is a quorum. So if everyone can pause for a moment, we'll just verify that before we continue.
This is Pam Cortez. Do you want to maybe just have people mute? You can call through the role of the committee members and then have people just briefly unmute and say they're here or not, potentially.
Yeah, we have, hold on one second. Yeah, we have everybody's name, so it's just that we can decide also if there's a quorum without ever having to go through and everyone unmute, but yes, we can also unmute you one at a time and introduce. So give us a second. The main person was not able to rejoin, so give us a second here while we try to organize it. Okay, everyone, thank you for your patience. We're having some audio issues. There's a lot of feedback when we unmute people, so we're not going to go down the list, but Rosa will be looking to see if there's a quorum, and that just really pertains to the minutes, so we may have to redo that, but we'll verify that by the end. I think the main point of this meeting this afternoon was to understand in a discussion around COVID-19, what your organization's roles and experience have been around this, and to share any learnings and feedback around that. So if you have a question, we're going to try to, we will, you know, be able to unmute you so you can share verbally. We do suggest that if you're calling in by both your computer and your phone, that creates that feedback that we're not able to hear anything. So if you can choose one or the other ways to communicate, that would be excellent. So one of the questions that we had to kick us off was around testing. This has been very hot, especially in long-term care facilities, around testing for residents and staff on a regular basis. And I was wondering if there's anyone here from long-term care facilities that could comment on if they've had discussion around that, how they're addressing it, any challenges.
This is Deborah Katora. Our staff just today received a notice that there is going to be a specific plan for testing of all staff and residents in the larger facilities, but it didn't contain any details yet. I certainly know, you know, individual places have been trying to do it, but I don't know what the success has been.
And so you're with DHS, just to remind everyone of your position. And so,
correct. I'm with DHS. I'm the staff RN consultant and the liaison with the health division. And we have foster homes where there's not been any current efforts for testing outside of their individual physician decisions. And then the assisted living, residential care, and nursing homes.
And do you expect that that long-term care facilities will need to come up with their own plans, or do you expect that there'll be some guidance along how and how often and this kind of thing?
Well, based on what the memo, and it was a pretty brief memo, but based on what the memo said, it sounded like that we are working with the health division on guidance. So my expectation is that there will be some specific guidance on how it will work.
Yeah, this is Tom Robbins. And we keep being told there's a plan coming, but we're lagging behind most other states with the plan for testing. So we're just waiting for guidance from OHA on what that entails. Because the recommendation has been only test symptomatic, not just test blank slate. So we're just kind of curious what the plan is. We haven't received anything yet.
And this is Deborah again. Once I get the memo with the, you know, with more specifics, I'd be happy to forward it, you know, so it can be shared with the group.
Great. And I'm sorry, who was speaking from someone that was speaking, this Tom Rollins that was speaking from long-term care. Are there, is there like particular areas of concern that you would want addressed in guidance? I know that we've had to do some testing around positive cases of both staff and residents, and you know, the logistical, et cetera, challenges. You know, some healthcare workers work at multiple facilities, et cetera. I was just wondering if there's any particular pieces that you would like to see addressed in such guidance.
Well, testing, the number of tests, getting testing, and it varies from county to county, which we've noticed. Some counties tell us they have no tests. Some counties have tests, but they only do it if they're asymptomatic. The guidance is supposed to be that to test all residents and staff on a routine basis. We don't know what that looks like yet. We're trying to scramble to try to find places to test en masse. We don't know if it's coming from the state, if the state's going to offer that. My understanding is that's the route that we're going, but we just don't know. We just need some guys like her to hear something. That would be great.
And I know that they're working on that and working out the details on that. Do you, your facilities in general have someone with the ability to collect samples in-house, or are you?
Yeah, we're nursing home. Mine's primarily nursing homes. I mean, that's the guidance is for nursing homes and assisted livings, but we have multiple nurses and all that can do testing. So it's just, we just need the kits. In Washington, they're providing all the kits for all the staff and residents. So we don't know what that looks like from Oregon. Do we need to get our own? Is Oregon supplying them? Who's paying for the staff? Is the state paying for that? Because the staff, that's a huge burden of cost on the centers, and I'm sure in adult foster homes as well and all that. Who's going to pay for all that?
Yes, these are all the questions
we're
asking too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad I'm not alone.
No, not at all.
And if you're working, how often are you expected to be tested?
Correct. And there have been different. And maybe some of the other healthcare systems can chime in, but if they've had outbreaks, but have talked about that week, that month, depend upon the prevalence in the community of that particular nursing home. So it may be different if you're a nursing home in Harney County, which is a nursing home in Multnomah. So there are those pieces as well.
Hi, this is Amy Orby. In an outbreak situation, we were able to secure tests from the county to do employees because of this situation. We were able to secure tests privately for our residents, but the whole, in that situation, there was a delay in the ability to test. We would have much preferred to test much sooner, but not having the availability of the testing materials, as was mentioned prior, and as we move forward, trying to secure tests for ongoing testing of our staff that did test negative, trying to, how is that going to happen? We're still scrambling to try and get plans in place for that. And so with the memo that just came out, having that information as soon as possible would be really beneficial as we try and secure test materials.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I know even the healthcare systems have had issues with test materials. Other comments regarding that or input? It's helpful to hear this.
My name is Kelly Coelho, and I represent Ambulatory Surgery Centers. I'm from Eugene, Springfield area. In our community, in our center itself, we are testing 100% of our patients. We do PCR testing when time allows, with test results to come back within 3 to 4 days, and then for cases that are added on that are emergent only, no elective cases, we are
We have rapid kit testing that our nurses do. We don't allow any patients to enter our center before the testing's done and the results are back. It's been a challenge to get the results back from where we do the PCR testing because it's going to Bellingham, Washington, and the turnaround. Just getting access to them and the report back has been our biggest challenge, but if we don't get them back, we don't do the case unless we have a negative result.
Is it just Jen, you did the follow-up, has your patient satisfaction been okay with that?
Pardon me?
The patient's been was doing the testing, any refusals, or
We've had one patient refuse just because they did not want the, it was a Kate Brown to determine whether they could, had to comply with the rules and stuff. But everybody else, they've given us some resistance, but they have to, we just tell them that it's really for our safety and theirs. We're doing procedures, we're intubating patients, and for aerosolizing procedures for the safety of our staff and the anesthesia providers, it's really a requirement. We can't move forward unless they agree to testing. Biggest challenges for us have been patients who are in the Roseburg area mainly, and then on the coast, just organizing them to get to a site where they can test. Coos Bay has, we send those patients, if they can't get tested in their community, we send them to Florence. Peace Health has a hospital there, and they're doing PCR testing. And then just different areas, just trying to figure out where in their community they can get tested. If not, they have to come here to Eugene Springfield area. And our hospital, Peace Health, is doing PCR testing at their urgent care sites, and they have a 72-hour turnaround. And then Mackenzie Willamette Hospital is doing PCR testing. It's a drive-up type testing, and they can have results within 24 hours, which has been really helpful. It gives us different options.
That sounds great. Yeah, it sounds like you've really come up with a good system there. Does it change your PPE at all that you use during surgery, or you?
Yes, we do.
As well.
They wear N95s during intubation and extubation, and then they allow 20 minutes for our room air exchanges to allow for anything that's airborne to be removed. But we've relaxed that since we've had 100% testing in place. Now we just do a regular 15-minute turnover because everybody is tested negative.
So this is Dennis Trapeza from Kaiser. We also have 3 ASCs. I'm wondering, so even with the negative test, you're still wearing the full PPE?
We are. Our staff is just more comfortable with an N95 because the patient's reporting self-isolation up to 3 to 4 days, and there's no guarantee that they're being truthful. Not that we expect that they're lying to us, but there is potential risk, and some people can show no symptoms and still have pretty good viral load. So, you know, there's anywhere from 3 to 4 days since their test occurred.
We're doing the same in long-term care per OHA's recommendation.
Yeah. We can't really get it.
Because the various tests are showing pretty high rates of positivity.
Dennis, maybe Dennis, we're saying, are you managing your surgical patients differently if they're positive or negative in your ORs or in your ASCs?
Yeah, in the ASCs, you know, since the majority of those are elective, we are not we're not proceeding with surgery. We're holding those off if they do test positive. Although I don't think we've had any positives yet, and so otherwise, no, we're proceeding with the cases of the negative.
But are you using N95s for intubation extubation for negative tests?
We are not using N95s with intubation or extubation.
Are there other students that would like to share their experience?
So this is Kirsten Chudy. I don't know if you can hear me. If somebody could give me some feedback that you can, I'd appreciate it before I keep talking.
Yeah, there you go. Ahead. Thank you.
Okay, great. Sorry with the audio difficulties here. Has there been any thoughts or discussion at the state about helping provide a framework with kind of threading the needle of testing and preserving testing in the setting of asymptomatic pre-surgical or admitted patients, as well as PPE conservation? Because I think what we're struggling with and the framework we're trying to put into place, which various societies and various organizations and certifying bodies around the country are all coming out with different guidance that kind of takes into maybe their either local situation or worst case scenarios that doesn't really apply to us currently with our low prevalence in Southern Oregon. You know, we're trying to put in place a process that at a low community prevalence, when the negative predictive value of the test is very good for high risk procedures that generate aerosols, we test. If the test is negative, we move towards normal PPE use, normal turnover. At an intermediate prevalence, I think, and that's where we could use some help defining that and making sure that we have the data we need from the state and at a regional level to help inform that. But at an intermediate level, then maybe risk stratifying, because, you know, what everyone's coming up with, aerosol-generating procedures, intubation, extubation, may be riskier than, you know, heavy breathing or exercise, which is also being classified by some groups as aerosol-generating. To say if you're a high-risk aerosol-generating procedure, you know, maybe then we use some extended PPE, even if you test negative, because, again, the positive predictive value of the test isn't as good in that setting, and we expect we may get some false negatives, and how many do you feel comfortable letting slip through the cracks? Whereas in a high prevalence setting, we move maybe even away from testing, unless it's for reporting purposes, if we're not going to manage the patient differently and say, you know, we don't feel comfortable that our test gives us a good enough answer. And that if they're testing negative, they are truly negative and not contagious, then maybe we need to be using higher level PPE in that setting. So has there been any thought about kind of risk stratifying based on community disease prevalence?
This is Mary, and I can just, I know, I'm just supporting what you're saying. We have looked at the same issue because I would say we're more moderate risk and there's not real clear guidance on what to do for moderate risk. So we just opted, instead of requiring N95 masks for the aerosol generating procedures, to go ahead and you know, have full face shields, surgical masks, and gowns and gloves for those scenarios. It's kind of the middle of the road.
Mary, could you, this is Jenny, could you clarify, is that for patients who test negative prior to procedure?
That is for aerosol-generating procedures. That's the position. I will tell you, our anesthesiologist in particular, and it sort of depends on the anesthesiologist, but they certainly are feeling more comfortable having N95 masks, even with negative pre-op test results.
And if there, this is Jenny Vann, if there's someone else who could comment either on that or in Kirsten Schutte's comments. I did want to call out, if you're not already aware, the OHA does publish case counts and deaths and positive negative tests and count for 10,000 by county. Which isn't as granular, of course, as a locality, but may be a way to you know, at least understand the different prevalence across the state and how that might affect your pre- and post-test screening. And I did want to bring up that in the comment box, there's a good comment that the rapid tests are having a bulk negative rate between 18% and 46%, and I mean, there's quite a large range, but in general, the laboratory community agrees that the rapid tests have a higher false negative rate than the PCR testing when it's well done. Hence the general preference. Are other systems using testing to change the level of PPE for aerosol generating procedures? I'm also thinking maybe for ENT settings or...
Okay, this is Susan from Legacy, and I can share a little bit about what we've done for our AGPs and testing as well. So we have a document in which we've categorized things. We've found that not only do we have to tell people what an AGP is, but also what's not an AGP. So we've categorized as a high-risk AGPs, low-risk AGPs, and then not an AGP. And then within the document, we've also stratified when you would use PAPR or if it tested N95, essentially airborne in contact. And those are any person under investigation or lab-confirmed COVID-19. And then we have moved through with asymptomatic or a negative, so negative COVID screen. So they weren't tested, but they don't have any signs or symptoms per screening. And so that we categorize for anyone that's doing a low-risk aerosolizing generating procedure, and again, we have a list of those. They're in droplet contact, but if they're doing a high-risk one, then we do a PAPR with the FIT-tested N95. We have anyone who's asymptomatic and negative screen, negative test, then we just do standard precautions. That includes any AGP. We've worked considerably hard on this, and we've pretty much got pretty good buy-in. You know, there's always one or two physicians or nurses that kind of push back, but for the most part, it's worked really well. And really spelling out, like, and kind of holding firm to this. So we had a really good group of anesthesiologists and ID physicians and intensivists and hospitalists that worked on making this document succinct for our staff. We also do test prior to surgery, so that any elective surgery, I should say. So if they're planned, then we'll do testing ahead of time. If they're an unplanned, urgent trauma, whatnot, we'll try to do the express test as much as possible to get some information ahead of time. But they tend to err on the side of, you know, again, that high risk AGP, they'll wear N95s or PAPRs. Hope that helps. So we should be all good now.
All right, Paul C's like listening in.
Thank you, Paul.
Oh, sorry, okay. I didn't mean to interrupt anything.
No, we're good. I was just making sure. Okay, we can go back to our discussion.
Great, thank you, ladies. Genevieve, so Susan, thank you for sharing that. Question, follow up on your AGP list. I don't know if other people have this question, but I know this has been a hot topic as well for Providence. Is your list of AGPs, is that, you know, the OA, the high risk, is that mostly the OHA list, or have you had to entertain a lot of other questions like laboring women and this kind of thing? And Susan, if you're trying to respond, you will need to unmute yourself.
Yep, there, thank you. Gosh, that was, yes, we do follow the OHA document, but we have had to take into consideration some of the professional organizations that have written in their own. And again, that was sort of reviewed really closely, but found that for the most part, what we got from OHA was right for what we did. We, for second stage of labor, we do have an opt-in for N95s. For the provider. So we have a few little allowances here and there for things like that, and we still get challenged on things, but for the most part, yeah.
This is Kirsten Schutte. We've had a lot of
questions about this as well, and rather than trying to deal with this as a one-off, we've been trying to compile a more comprehensive list. I can send it out to the group, but the best one that I came across a couple of days ago was from Mayo Clinic on their Ask Mayo Expert website, and so they have kind of created a spectrum where they extend from high risk to intermediate risk to low risk, and also they reference what PPEs they're using at each of those levels given their current disease prevalence. I don't know if they change in the future, if that changes, and they've also created a list of outpatient procedures as well as inpatient procedures that they require testing for prior to undergoing those procedures. So I thought it was very helpful, and we're currently working to get our policy in place with kind of that robust information.
That's very helpful, and you just, is that on the Mayo website? Or like Mayo?
It's through Ask Mayo Expert, so I'll send out the link. I don't know if it would be easy to search for. It was posted in one of the Society of Healthcare Epidemiologists of America listservs that I get.
That'd be great. Thank you very much. Other challenges, comments around AGPs, that kind of thing? And I do see there's other questions in the question box that are coming up too, but I just want to see if there's anybody else would like to share their experience around this and how it affects PPE use. And if not, I see that Jesse Kennedy would be happy to share about ONA's role and experiences. So I don't know if you'd like to go ahead and unmute yourself and share. That'd be great. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Thanks, Jess. Like Jess, Matt, and Jesse, you and I have talked a little bit about PPE over the last couple of months.
Yes, definitely. I think, so as far as ONA's role has been regarding all of this, I have been scouring all of the ONA, CDC, or sorry, all the OHA, CDC, and WHO sites daily, several times a day, to try to compile what the guidelines say in mass to try to make sure that everybody is on the same page. I would say as far as the challenges go with that, there are a lot of variances, as I'm sure everybody knows, but I think the most difficult variances to account for are the varying guidelines from individual document, whether we're talking about CDC or OHA or WHO, but just that one document might say one thing in vague terms while another document from the same group published at about the same time says something a little bit different. So it's been really difficult to provide concrete guidance to all of the nurses and other healthcare workers throughout the state regarding what the current guidelines are. I would say that there has been also a lot of variance within the individual facilities as far as what those guidelines are interpreted as. For example, some facilities are still utilizing facility disaster plans while resuming the non-urgent and non-emergent or elective procedures, which doesn't align with what's going on. And I think there's definitely a lot of work moving forward for all of the facilities to be aware of what the guidelines are, to be able to provide the appropriate protections for our nurses and frontline healthcare workers. I think a lot of work on individual level to help bring facilities into alignment. But overall, there's a large amount of variation as far as what is acceptable, and a lot of variation as far as what facility disaster plans include. And so it's been a lot of work to try to figure out what the responses are within the state. So I think moving forward, it would be fantastic to be able to have some better work groups to really sit down and talk about what disaster planning looks like if we are going to have this second surge, this fall surge that coincides with our influenza surge. It would be really helpful if we could get all of the facilities and folks here and people throughout the state to sit down and talk together about what it would look like if we do see that surge so that we can anticipate it. Because right now we're still kind of limping along. Most places are getting by pretty well right now. But as we all know, we're already seeing a pretty big surge in many states, Arizona, California, Texas, and those are mostly related to the reopening. But as we reopen and get closer to the influenza season, it would be really beneficial to all of the public within our state, as well as folks that are caring for the public, be able to sit down and make sure we all have a comprehensive plan about what it is we're going to do when this comes back. Because as I'm sure everybody saw, the EPA is renewing some of the EUAs, and so it would be good to make sure everybody's on the same page so that we know what we're talking about. We all know what the most appropriate PPE is, and we are all working together towards the same goal of protecting our citizens and our healthcare members.
Thank you, Jesse. This is Rosa. I think that this is something that we all, we want to see across the board. And I don't, I don't want to speak to this in too much detail because I don't think we know the best way to kind of bring folks together. But maybe since Paul is on the line, Paul, do you think there is, what? Like, is there a way for us to kind of facilitate some feedback or discussion amongst our various stakeholders, or would you suggest a particular way for them to out if you're on the line still?
I would think this would be the right group, no?
I would think so. Yeah. And certainly we'll be passing along the kind of the conversations that are being had during this meeting, right? So I think this is one opportunity to kind of talk about what we would like to be seeing in our facilities or among our kind of constituents, Jesse, and your case as working at the LNA. I think that, just to reflect generally on this, I think that, there are still shortages of PPE, and we don't know, what we're going to be seeing in terms of cases rising or declining or plateauing in the coming weeks. And so I think that at the very least, to some degree, we're going to have to continue with, some PPE optimization, at least for the time being.
I know we're not entirely out of the woods yet. I would really appreciate the ability to work together to work towards a framework for the future should this happen again, because we do know that PPE is still short right now, and facilities are following the PPE optimization guidelines, hopefully not falling into that contingency area. But I just want to make sure that as we are talking about this, that we can anticipate some of those things. I mean, I was on the Ebola Response Force when that was a big thing. And we had several meetings. We trained several nurses in the state, designated what was going to happen, what sort of PPE was going to be held between different facilities. So I would just like to see something, whether it's our group, which I think would be entirely appropriate, or an additional group to come and find what the appropriate interventions would be should we start to see what we're hearing we probably will see.
So I just want to say this just because I think we need to, that because this is a public meeting and this is a, you know, an advisory committee, unfortunately, any kind of convening of this group together needs to be a public meeting as well. So I'll just say that. But I think now is a good time to have some of these conversations or during subsequent IAC meetings. And then, of course, anyone can feedback directly with them.
This is Deborah Couture with DHS. One of the things that I hope that we focus a little bit on is some of the things that we're seeing in our outpatients, aside from whether or not there's enough PPE available, is failures in, and this is a licensed staff, failure of washing their hands when they were using PPE, not using it properly or not, you know, removing it properly. And I think that that's, you know, just as important as discussing how to manage the PPE, because if you're not doing some of those other basics, you've got gaps. And I think the other issue that always faces any kind of large crisis like this is PPE, basically people becoming tired and sort of cutting corners. Fatigue, that's the word I wanted. To address the fatigue of, you know, the PPE. So when people were trying to do it right, but they had, you know, heavy workloads, working long hours, that kind of thing.
I think one of the things that we've been kind of advocating, and I don't want to, you know, I would love to hear from folks who have been doing this, is that, you know, ongoing education and training for staff is just so important. Even if it's just a couple of minutes every once in a while, you know, because I think there are a lot of facilities that are sending information out, doing online trainings, and I think that sometimes that personalized sort of one-on-one verbal and participatory element of education is also really important. But I'm curious to know, thank you for saying that, I'm curious to know if other folks have been seeing that same issue.
I would agree with that entirely, and also, you know, add to that from the perspective that it is incredibly beneficial when we can provide that continuing education in a format that provides continuing education credits for our nurses that are looking to get certifications and raise their level of professionalism within the profession. And so I would greatly appreciate any sort of movement in that direction as far as continuing education for infection prevention, but also continuing education professionalism related to infection prevention, epidemiology, and all those similar avenues.
Hi, this is Paul. Jen and I were having kind of a side conversation in the chat box. Jen, are you available to talk? Can you talk?
Yes, I am. I got it so you could be unmuted.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was not exactly understanding what you were saying, but I was saying that regarding PPE, you know, there's a couple of resources out there. One is that CDC has offered guidance on, you know, what is conventional, you know, what to be used in conventional circumstances, that is, you know, when there's no shortage, then contingency circumstances, and then crisis circumstances, you know, any port in a storm kind of, if all you've got is a cloth mask, use it kind of crisis setting. But But this stuff is also tied into the reopening phases for the various counties so that the PPE is in, you know, if there's dire shortages, then presumably you'd be back to a different phase of COVID-19 reopening. And then Richard has his crisis care guidance, which I think may have touched upon this, but he works with a medical advisory group. And so I was thinking, well, maybe that would be a good group to get engaged if you had more specific questions about PPE.
And Paul, I can make that connection via email with Richard and Jesse now, or soon.
Yeah, so Genevieve, I wasn't quite understanding what you were saying in the chat box.
Well, that's what I was referring to, because there has been actually quite a lot of work with the healthcare systems and public health regarding the different levels of crisis versus contingency versus normal functioning, and how that relates to use of PPE, visitor restrictions, and other details like that. So I think maybe we just need to get you associated or introduced to that group where the conversations have been going on. There is always going to be differences at the level of the individual healthcare system and facility because of differences in supply chains what they're doing. So some of that exists, and then also some healthcare systems have interstate systems that complicate things as well. But these are all great questions. Anyway, that was I was trying to remember the name of that committee with Paul and figure out what was the name of it. But I think it is the Medical Advisory Committee and other things. And also through the Tri-County and County Health Departments too, we've had a lot of discussions around that.
This is Josh from the Oregon Clinic Supply Chain Manager. Kind of lined up with what you just said about going down to the county individual hospital level. That would be nice when some of these recommendations are coming out. I know, like when Governor Brown mentioned a couple weeks ago that PPE was in ample supply, that just wasn't the case for facilities that didn't have allocations. And yeah, we were able to get PPE from the county, but unfortunately it comes, you know, it's not guaranteed you're getting, you know, 1,000 of the 1860s or of the duck bills, and our staff was only fit tested for certain ones, so then we had to redo fit tests, which then led into shortages trying to find the items to be able to do fit tests. So I had a lot of doctors coming down where, well, the governor and the state's saying PPE is an ample supply. Well, technically you could say that, but it's not a one-size-fits-all model. So I mean, that caused a lot of heartache for the supply chain team, at least for us.
This is Sandra, speaking from WSHA. Can you hear me? Hi. So I kind of shared that since we had the surge go a little bit before it hit Oregon here, we may be able to share some information and some lessons learned with you. I've been working every week on an IP forum, age infection preventionists, many from Oregon and some from Alaska, to join us on phone calls to kind of like the pulse from the IP perspective. But along with that, we also work with the Healthcare Emergency Coordination Center, and they have been doing a really good job. They were created with the Ebola funding, and what they do is they track each of the different districts according to what the space is, what the staffing is, what the supplies are, so that they can be managed really easily between the different groups. The governor of Washington also has an admiral coordinating the COVID-19 work through his office, which has been very helpful. Admiral Bono has weekly phone calls with WSHA staff and other leaders throughout the state in terms of managing that. In terms of some of the PPE, and I'm just hitting some broad things, but we have a lot of information that we could potentially share with you. But in terms of managing PPE, we obviously had some shortages. We had shortages of gowns. We needed to figure out what to do. We went through figuring out if Zyrtec, I don't know if that's the allergy medication, but the something tech outfits that some emergency responders wear, that's not good to wear as a replacement because people can self-infect. We learned that for each different type of N95, whether it's an N95 or a KN95 or whatever, there has to be unique fit testing with all of those. We ran out of some of the testing solution for the K95 fit testing. So there's an abundance of information that we could share. We also learned that, you know, for some of the rural hospitals or the ones that were particularly hard hit were those that service migrant and seasonal farm workers and Latinx populations because of different cultural issues. And so we also had to deal with some language problems, cultural issues, things like that. So I can just say that there's a wealth of information. One of the things that OSHA has me do is each week I have to work on compiling what happened, because there's such a wealth of information out there. So the areas that I first started out focusing on were any changes with CDC, WHO, with regard to PPE, with regard to environmental cleaning, with regard to other types of shortages, and anything that I saw that looked like it might impact the work that we're doing. So I don't know if any of that can help, but certainly Oregon's still welcome to participate with us on the IP forum. Did you hear me?
Yes, we sure did. If there's anything, resources you'd like to be able to share with the group, go ahead and share those with Rosa, and she'll be able to share them with the fuller group. So, yeah, thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Jen. That's a great idea. For those folks who do want to share things, with your colleagues, I can compile them and send them out. And then I think, we'll be sending out meeting minutes as usual. And I think just the topics that are coming up on this call are really crucial. So thank you so much for sharing all of this.
You're welcome. Also, some of the things that you may be come across to deal with is a shortage of vendors. So we actually had people in China on the grounds go and vet some of our supplies, and we've had WSHA staff go out and deliver it to hospitals too.
Yes, thank you. I know then the previous speaker too had mentioned the supply chain issues, even the healthcare systems have dealt with faulty supply chains and having to pull those back after receiving them because they were poor quality. So anything can be done to vet that before you receive?
Yes. Yep.
And if there's other comments or questions around supply chain challenges? Kind of again on PPE front, Mary Post had a question wondering how many facilities are moving to universal eye protection for front-facing staff. And if anyone would like to comment, if you could clarify, are you using goggles or face masks? Are you reprocessing them, duration of wear, things like that?
Thank you.
This is Rosa. I have a question.
Oh, sorry.
Just to piggyback off of that, if there's any kind of lessons learned regarding best practices for storage of things like eye protection, you know, we kind of have the paper bag model for our N95, but I think face shields pose a slightly different set of challenges, so I'm just curious if anyone has any best practices around that as well. But
well, this is Tom Rollins for Prestige. We, in our center, long-term care centers, we are using face shields. First of all, they're more comfortable on the staff than goggles or anything like that. And they seem to last longer and don't fog up as much, obviously. And then as far as storage, what we do is when they come out, we have little cubbies outside of each room with disinfectant in them, and then they disinfect and throw them into a bin after disinfection, after hand hygiene, all that stuff. But that helps us with the reusable ones. We also have disposable ones, but we don't like those as well. The foam doesn't last and doesn't hold up. Yeah, for PPE and long-term care, we are having to go to contingency and crisis conservation much more frequently, probably, than hospitals are at this point. We're using cloth gowns. We're using face masks for a whole shift. I mean, trying to find PPE for us has been a very difficult endeavor, for sure.
This is Sandra from Wishakin, and you know, using those cloth gowns seemed to be like a really great solution in Washington because you could launder them, and that gets rid of the COVID virus. So that's a really useful way to go. Yeah,
we're using that. The only issue is we're getting mixed messages about reuse. So it's after each use, you have to launder it, is what the state is saying, not Oregon Health Authority necessarily, but it's been very difficult. We're getting many mixed night surveyors versus Oregon Health Authority versus the website. Yeah. That's where the problem comes in for us, is because we're so heavily regulated that we're getting lost into what's the right. I just want us to do the right thing. I can deal with regulation and stuff later. I just want to do the right thing that keeps our folks safe. So, you know, we're told we can reuse cloth gowns and hang them inside the room, and then we'll launder them at the end of the shift for an aide or a CNA. But then we have surveyors that come in and say you have to launder between each use, and which then we don't have the supply of cloth gowns. It's like we don't have thousands of them sitting in buildings waiting to be used and laundered.
Yeah.
It's too difficult, you know.
Yep. We were really lucky. We had some people make cloth gowns for some of the long-term care facilities. And then I believe it was also some of the aprons that are used in the kitchens with the long sleeves. They were worn backwards as a potential solution, too.
Yeah, we've used lots of several different, like, painting coveralls. The staff really like those because they cover everything. And they have hoods, so it protects their head. They kind of thought those were pretty cool. But in Washington, we have centers in Washington, too, and it's been very a much different experience from this perspective, because they're giving pretty succinct guidance, like, yep, you can do this, and we're just getting mixed messages in Oregon. So.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, Washington's been great. So if we could get some succinct guidance in Oregon, that would be super great.
This is great, everyone. This is Genevieve. Thanks for all the questions and comments so far. We are coming up on our last 5 or 6 minutes of the meeting today, so I do want to move us to our next item of future topics and public comment, and Rosa has a quick update. I would like to suggest, though, if there are questions that come up and challenges, I'd like to encourage you to email them to Rosa. She can share them with the group, and that might be one forum to get some responses from your colleagues, whether in long-term care facilities or healthcare systems. So that might be a possibility if we can't get to everything today, or if there are issues that arise. Rosa, is that okay and appropriate? Sorry to put you on.
It's absolutely perfect, yes. And this is a shorter meeting than our normal 2 hours. We wanted to just really focus on providing a forum here for people to chat with one another And we also, you know, recognize that taking the folks who are on this call are a really crucial pieces of our infection control infrastructure here in Oregon and in Washington. So we didn't want to, you know, absorb too much of your time. Please send me any thoughts, questions, comments. We will do our best. Resources we will share. I just wanted to briefly mention that we do still have several vacancies on our advisory committee. I can't say I've been doing much outreach recently trying to get these vacancies filled, considering it feels like there are other things taking precedence at the moment. But to this group, I will just remind that we are still looking for a health insurer representative, a consumer or patient advocate, a hospital administrator at a facility of fewer than 100 beds, and a representative of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. If you happen to know of anyone who is interested, I think everyone received in their meeting materials that Bring Your Voice to the Table one pager. It has the basic info about the HIAC and my contact information on it. So hopefully we can, you know, hopefully we will have more opportunity to get those vacancies filled going forward. So if anyone is able to pass that message along, and Jen, I'll turn it back to you.
Great, thank you. So went over a lot of things. I definitely, just to summarize, heard some asks around some clear guidance on PPE levels in crisis contingency, how testing might change PPE, how to be very clear with recommended PPE in sort of non-hospital settings, long-term care facilities. So, you know, these are suggestions, thank you, that we can also bring back to the groups, the other groups that are working on those questions. So thank you. So next I'd like to turn for any topics for future meetings or reports that people would like to hear about. Our next meeting will be in September. Just to give you, to remind you of that. Are there any topics that folks would like us to address? Thank you.
You know, yeah, this is Dennis Trevisa from Kaiser. You know, we just had an ASC survey conclude today from AAAHC, and I'm still really interested in our comparison amongst the ASCs in Oregon for some of our HEIs. Like, what SSIs are we following that are similar, and if there's any learnings we can get from organizations that are doing well. Because I know that we post that across the board for hospitals and long-term care vaccination rates, but the ASC part is where I'm really like, it'd be really nice to have something like that.
Dennis, can I ask, and then just as a group, you know, we did have a dialysis-themed meeting in March, and we could potentially think about having a sort of a meeting where we do some extra engagement of our ASC colleagues. We have some folks from ASCs who we really, really appreciate hearing from because it's a perspective we don't get to hear as much of. So I don't know if folks want to think that's a good idea. Of course, I mean, we're wanting to be really responsive to the situation as it unfolds, right? Is that the reason why we're kind of doing a little bit of an unusual meeting this time? But it's something we could consider for September. You can email me your thoughts as well.
Great suggestion. Anybody else? Or any suggestions? And if nothing's coming to mind, again, you can always email Rosa. Finally, I need to leave it open to any public comment. If there's anything else that folks would like to say in regards to the HEI Advisory Committee suggestions, et cetera, this is your time. Okay, with that, in our final minute, I just want to thank everybody for bearing with us during our technical difficulties and staying engaged and sharing your opinions and questions, and we look forward to seeing you in September. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Facilitating this discussion.
Thanks. Very welcome. Be well, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.